Today's episode is brought to you by Surfshark. Today, with practically everything being done online, your online privacy is paramount and you can enjoy peace of mind knowing that your online privacy is improved and protected from hackers 24/7 by the award-winning Surfshark. How? Well, their main product, VPN, basically acts as a shield, so when your device connects to the internet, all that information is, in a way, encrypted. So anyone who tries to snoop on you won't be able to see what you're doing or where you're doing it all from. Everything you do online stays private. Its antivirus offers powerful device protection, securing everything from your webcam to your files. Alternative ID can generate a new online identity and a proxy email for you. Surfshark Alert enhances your security further with instant data leak notifications, and you can even browse ad-free without digital footprints using the Surfshark search engine. Plus, if you use a VPN, you can virtually travel the world from the comfort of your own home, and Surfshark gives you more than 100 countries to choose from. Once you change your virtual location, you'll be able to bypass censorship and restrictions. Find your favourites on Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, or other streaming services, and even access new libraries to watch even more content. Say, you can't see a YouTube video because of your location. Use Surfshark VPN. Struggling to access that website to buy limited edition goods? Use Surfshark VPN. Try it today, totally risk-free, with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Secure your privacy with Surfshark. Enter coupon code TRUECRIMEPOD for an extra 3 months free at surfshark.deals/truecrimepod. Yes, 3 months free. That's surfshark.deals/truecrimepod. Hello all, and the very warmest of welcomes to the True Crime Enthusiast podcast, coming to you from my North Wales corner where I strive to seek out those tales of true crime that are less familiar and often forgotten from the darkest depths of the UK and Ireland. Doing so is myself, Paul, the creator, host and true crime enthusiast of the show's title, my beloved one-eyed, four-tooth, three-lined cineman, Peaksy, the true crime enthusiast cat, is here as ever, and completing us are yourselves, the wonderful enthusiasts that keep the show driving forward. It is as fabulous as always having you join us today. My thanks for doing so. And I hope that as you have, then it's for an episode that finds you and yours all good, all safe, and all well. So the tale I bring this time around then is a lot more recent than those usually covered, indeed. Less than 18 months has passed since the events you'll hear within. But when I came across it and began researching, it's one that stuck with me and that I've been compelled to deliver here now on the show. It recounts a crime that is truly senseless in every meaning of the word. A crime for which we head to the city of Nottingham, in the shire of the same name, and back to the penultimate week of November 2022. The episode contains details and descriptions of crimes and events involving children that some listeners may find disturbing and or distressing, so please use discretion whilst you're listening in all. Bearing that in mind, please join the True Crime Enthusiast for an episode I've entitled Neighbour from Hell. Back in November 2022, then 39-year-old Aboubakar Dramé had several things to be thankful for and to look forward to. At the time working as a biomedical technician at a laboratory in Minnesota in the United States, he was late that November preparing to head back to the UK to the Clifton area of Nottingham for what he planned would be one of the final times he was ever to do so, ostensibly to see his family. His wife of 9 years, 28-year-old Fatoumata Hayadara, and the couple's two daughters, 3-year-old Fatima and her year-old sister, Naima. Aboubakar had been working in the US for several years by then, though visiting home regularly, and for the best part of the previous 3 years, the family had been preparing the visa application so that Fatoumata and the girls could head over to the US to join him permanently and for them to be a family again. Now, these processes are understandably lengthy and can be quite stressful, but the family were coming to the end of theirs, and his return trip to the UK had been planned for November the 29th, so the family could attend a final interview for their visa application at the US Embassy in London as part of their plans to emigrate. However, he was to make it back to the UK much earlier than that, but for reasons he never, in his most horrific of nightmares, could have ever imagined. Aboubakar recalled at the time, "We had an interview booked for 29th of November, and that would have been the final interview before we would hopefully have secured their visas. That's not going to happen now, and I can't understand why." On Saturday the 19th of November 2022, Fatoumata and the two girls had arrived at their home, number 23 Fair Isle Close, an upstairs one-bedroom flat in the Clifton area of Nottingham, where they had lived for several years, after spending the previous few days staying with Fatoumata's mother, Aminata Dibber. They'd gone to stay there because Fatoumata had several pressing medical appointments that week and needed help with the children, so, perfect solution, stay with the grandparents, who doted on their granddaughters and spoiled them rotten during this visit. The girls were still suitably wound up, lively and excitable by the early evening, arguing over new toys their grandmother had given them, so much so that when her mother telephoned her just before 6 p.m. that evening, Fatoumata remarked that she doubted she would ever be able to get them to settle down and eventually ready for bed. Ultimately, Fatoumata managed to do so, and at 10:22 p.m. that evening, she WhatsApp called her husband in Minnesota. Speaking for just over 30 minutes, Fatoumata told Aboubakar that both the children were asleep, and then they discussed their respective days and his upcoming trip back, his first since September of that year, before she ended the call at 10:54 p.m. telling him she was going to bed. In July 2023, Aboubakar recalled to a court, specifically addressing a defendant. "On that evening of November the 19th, the conversation was normal. I went to bed at night and woke up for early morning prayers. It was 5 a.m. when I got the call. While I was praying, my phone started ringing continuously, and I thought it was Fatoumata wanting to FaceTime. We all know it wasn't. It was my mother-in-law and my sister, so I called back my mother-in-law and she started crying. She said there had been a fire and the kids didn't make it and that Fatoumata was in the intensive care unit. But it wasn't an accident, was it? My trip to the UK that November the 21st was unplanned. I just went straight to the airport and flew back alone to the UK. I've done that journey so many times, but all the other times it's been exciting because I was going to see my family. This time around, I still can't recall it. It's just a blur. I was escorted to the ICU and Fatoumata was in an ICU bed. I stood there, watching the movement on the monitor, and I knew the odds. Had the basic knowledge of healthcare." Fatoumata was indeed fighting for her life, deep in a coma that she was never to awaken from, for at 11:09 a.m. on the morning of Wednesday the 22nd of November, doctors at the Queen's Medical Centre in Nottingham, after results of brainstem death tests, certified her as having died. Tragically, she was to be the third family member that Aboubakar had to identify in the hospital mortuary, for the couple's two daughters, Fatima and Naima, were already there ahead of her. Just hours after the family had returned home from staying with Fatoumata's mother, there had indeed been a fire, and despite fraught attempts to save them by firefighters and paramedics, Naima and Fatima were sadly certified dead shortly after arriving at the QMC. Fatimata and her two children had each died from smoke inhalation, post-mortems finding each having lethal levels of carboxyhemoglobin in their blood. Abubakar described to Nottingham Crown Court the following year that that week had been, and remained, the hardest of his life, and that he would never get over spending his 40th birthday, which happened to be that Wednesday, in the mortuary, adding, "I had to go in there and see the bodies. That was just so hard. Two little angels, their lifeless bodies laying next to each other. I held their cold hands, and I wished I could switch with them. Only Allah knows why. I have to accept and prepare for the next chapter of my life. All I can say is, I am sorry I was not there. I should have been. I had a responsibility as a father and a husband to protect. That was my basic responsibility. I make no excuses. Because of you, and only you, I failed in my only responsibility as a father. I was hopeless and I was left helpless because I didn't have a family and it was the people who mattered most to me. Since then, it has been a downward plunge into darkness and the unknown. It was unthinkable, it was unplanned, and I wish this on no one else, including you." Now, if it had been a tragic accident, what I've described would already be horrific beyond imagination, I'm sure you'll agree. But what worsens it is that it was no accident. The fire was started in an act of cold, deliberate murder, horror that I shall get onto shortly. Descriptions of Fatimata, the oldest of five children who had moved to Nottingham aged 14 with her Gambian parents, that I've come across through researching this tale have been universal and almost verbatim. But it's perhaps fitting for Abubakar and Fatimata's family to describe her best in words that they gave to the press in the days following losing the family, with Abubakar, who had a pet name for his beloved wife, "My Paradise" or "My Heaven," saying, "Fatimata was modest, honest and obedient. She was a Muslim, and she truly believed in her faith. She maintained and valued her Islamic traditions, African culture, yet assimilated into British society. Trust me, she loved fish and chips, and we used the same stores you used. She was caring and compassionate. She volunteered her time and worked when she could. She'd help whoever she could. If you'd knocked on her door to ask for help, money, food, just someone to talk to, she would have. She used to work for St. John's Ambulance and delivered many babies as part of her work, as well as working in various care homes looking after the elderly. She was just interested in helping others. She really wanted to pursue a career in women's health." Indeed, Fatimata had a passion for working with people suffering with mental illnesses and was greatly loved by them. She was admired so much that, reportedly, often after her shift had ended, she was called back in to calm down certain patients who would only listen to her because of the thoughtful relationships she'd formed with them. Abubakar continued, "She loved the kids. They did a lot of baking together and fun things in the house. They would make cookies and cupcakes and loved putting the icing on the cakes. We also really enjoyed vacations. We've been to places like Edinburgh, Plymouth and the Gambia, where we're both from. Family was so important to us and spending time together. We just wanted to bring the kids up to be role models and good citizens. We wanted to move to the US, but regardless of where we were in the world, the most important thing to us was to give them a better life and a good education. I lost, her parents lost, her family and friends lost, but Nottingham and the entire UK also lost a great human being." Abubakar also paid an emotional tribute to his two young daughters, who he would talk to every day on FaceTime, describing Fatima, who attended nursery school at Nottingham's Milford Academy, as loving playing and watching children's TV. He said she loved Omar and Hannah and then started getting into Peppa Pig. She also loved nursery rhymes, and when on FaceTime with me, she'd make me do the head, shoulders, knees and toes song. Like her elder sister, Abubakar said his youngest daughter, Naima, who had just turned one that July, also lived a short but meaningful life that had been filled with joy and happiness, saying. Naima also enjoyed TV shows, but her favourite thing was milk. She'd eat a lot of foods like rice, but she really enjoyed milk. She started walking a little late, but then she became confident and started dragging things around and moving stuff. They were both really happy children. They loved spending time with their grandparents and got along really well as siblings. Speaking of her loss, Aminata Dibber told Nottinghamshire Live, "Fatoumata was my oldest daughter. I had her when I was very young. She was my best friend. Every time when she wanted to wear something or buy something, she would always come to me. She was very vibrant and bubbly, and she was always smiling. She had a very kind heart. She came on Thursday and left on Saturday, just a day before the fire. And that is the last time I saw her. An awful coincidence." Aminata added, "The only thing that would bring us peace is justice for our beautiful girl. We want to thank the police because they were quick, and I also want to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart for their support. This tragedy does not feel real, and it all feels like a nightmare at the moment. It's very hard to understand why this happened to such a beautiful and kind woman. Everyone who knew her loved her. My heart is aching every day. I cannot sleep. I lost my best friend and my two grandchildren." Now, I could have countlessly gone on like this, and I will come back to personal recollections later on in the tale. Where we shall now go is to the horrific actions which led to such recollections even being a thing. It was in the early hours of the morning of the 20th of November 2022. 3:12 a.m. to be exact, and a sleeping Fatoumata didn't hear the sound of the letterbox to the front door of their property, the only exit for them from the first floor flat, being prized and wedged open. Nor did she hear the sound of a clean and fresh spray bottle, chosen deliberately because its slim neck would fit neatly through a letterbox, its contents having been discarded and replaced with petrol siphoned from a motorcycle, being pushed through, and the contents then emptied onto the stairs carpet, then ignited with burning tissue paper. In fact, the moment Fatoumata certainly first heard something amiss can be pinpointed at 3:13 and 27 seconds, the seconds become important, thanks to CCTV belonging to a neighbour of hers, Chris McGowan, which was to prove crucial in the subsequent investigation, indeed, as was footage from several other CCTV cameras also. There was no CCTV covering the front door of number 23, but significant footage from Mr. McGowan's further up the close that was examined later showed five important time-stamped events, these being: at 3:13 and 10 seconds, a flare of light. That was the time at which the arsonist set fire to the petrol. 3:13, 27 seconds, when the fire alarm at number 23 started sounding, which would have woken Fatoumata and the children. From 3:13 and 49 seconds to 3:13 and 55, the sound of screaming and banging. The screaming starting about 20 seconds after the fire alarm activated. At 03:15 and 22 seconds, the sound of further screaming, and at 03:15 and 55 seconds, a second flare of light. The emergency services were contacted at 3:17 and 50 seconds, just over 4 minutes after the fire alarm had started to sound at Fatoumata's flat, and within moments after the first call, firefighters from stations across the county were racing to the scene of the fire. One engine from West Bridgeford Fire Station, two from London Road, and one from Highfields, as neighbours evacuated in the night clothes on the street and a crowd gathered, shocked by the scene they saw. As I said, the front door was their only means of escape, and the stairwell up to their flat had acted like a chimney to the thick black smoke which had seeped into the flat and was now billowing from the upstairs windows of the family home. The first team of firefighters who had arrived at 3:28 a.m. included Catherine Swales and Patrick Lee, who noticed a pushchair outside before they entered, wearing breathing apparatus, and headed upstairs. It was hard for them to communicate because of the acrid smoke making it impossible to see anything, and the intense heat. The temperature was so high that Catherine's thermal imaging camera had stopped working. But the firefighters quickly found Fatoumata lying on the floor next to the sofa, and Fatima lying next to her, both of them unresponsive. Between the two, though it was a struggle to move and lift them due to the conditions in the flat, they managed to get both outside before firefighters James Smith and Andrew Alexander took over. The second crew found Naima in a cot in the bedroom, also unresponsive, and brought her out, laying her next to her sister, who was by then being given CPR, as another firefighter began this procedure with Naima. They continued in this vein until paramedics arrived and took over from them. As we've said before with similar tales on the show, you would just ignore exhaustion, for you would never want to give up trying to save two little children, would you? Anu repeated this as the ambulance containing the two sped along Clifton Boulevard towards the QMC. But ultimately, it was to be in vain, and despite the best efforts of firefighters and medical staff, Fatima and Naima could not be saved. Less than 2 hours after that fire had been set, brought under control and extinguished, both girls were pronounced dead. Fatoumata, as I said, was to succumb to the effects of the fire just 2 days after her children, though never having regained consciousness. The fire devastated the tight-knit Clifton community, and the outpouring of grief brought shocked and saddened locals closer together. By 2 days after the fire, the all too familiar tributes that you will have seen 100 times before on the news, bunches of flowers left against cordons, cuddly toys and candles, you know what I mean, had built up, and by the following Sunday, friends, neighbours and people merely touched by the family's tragic story congregated at Holy Trinity with St. Francis Church on Farnborough Road in Clifton to pay their tributes. The vicar there, the Reverend Lydia Cartwright, said at the time, "Clifton will never forget this tragedy. There's been a steady flow of people coming in to pay their respects." Now indeed, they seemingly didn't forget. 10 days after the fire, the funeral of Fatoumata, Fatima and Naima was held, and hundreds congregated at the Bait al-Hafiz Mosque on Snainton Dale from 11:30 a.m. where members of the Muslim community passed their condolences to Fatoumata's family. In between the prayers at the Snainton Mosque, a heartfelt tribute to Fatoumata on behalf of the family was read out, which read, "She wanted to make her children good citizens of the world. She was always willing to help people whenever she could. She was a righteous woman and did her best to adhere to Islamic teachings and principles. She got along with her siblings very much and listened to her parents. She did her utmost best to maintain the happiness of her siblings ever since they were young. She still is a role model. They look up to her. Even the challenging struggles she went through in her life didn't change her character, her love for Allah and love for humanity. We're saddened greatly by her passing, yet have a feeling of great relief for her, as she has achieved what we have all been put on this earth to achieve. the prayer concluded with. She carried out her life in such a meaningful manner. She was extremely close to Allah. Great and gracious words were always on her tongue. So may Allah the Almighty bless them in paradise, and may they rest in eternal peace. May Allah grant the peace of the family, and may Allah protect the family from big losses and difficult situations in the future. Moving from the mosque, the funeral procession then arrived at Highwood Cemetery in Bulwell, where the burial took place at around 2 p.m, as is a Muslim tradition, attended only by males. Whilst females remained at the mosque and had lunch, sharing memories of Fatimata and her children. The following month, showing just how touched the community was by what had happened, Clifton residents organised a charity walk to raise money to support the family. The walk was set up by customers of the Fairham pub in Clifton, and licensee Kelly Taylor was quoted as saying that she felt she had to help after hearing of the tragedy, explaining, "The walk is to show the family the love and support that the Clifton community can offer. I know it's a sad time for them, but we want to do our little bit to give them a bit of hope. We felt we needed to do something as a community to show support, for it's such a tough time. I'm not doing it because I'm a pub landlady. I'm doing it because I'm a mum myself. It could have happened to me. It could have happened to anybody. Tragedy can strike when you least expect it, and you don't expect it on your own doorstep." Now, thanks to this walk and a GoFundMe page, thousands of pounds were raised for the family. I do always add in things like this to a tale I bring, because it is all about those affected, more so than those who are responsible. And little chinks of light from any darkness should be added, even if it's a short account of how a community comes together in support. By the time of this walk, however, by the time of the family's funeral even, as equally as the community were united in grief, they were also left reeling by the knowledge that one of their own had been arrested on suspicion of, and was by that time charged and awaiting trial for the murders of Fatimata, Fatima and Naima. Because no one from your community can possibly be responsible for such horror, can they? They come from outside, from a pit of hell, surely. Nope, not always. Sometimes, you never have to look further than next door. A short time after the fire had been extinguished early that Sunday, November morning, investigators had determined that the fire had been started deliberately with an accelerant, finding the seat of the fire clearly having been the base of the staircase behind the single door to number 23, which was accessed from an alleyway that ran behind the row of houses. As full standard inquiry procedures got underway from that Sunday morning, house-to-house inquiries in Fair Isle Close expanding outward, a look at Fatimata's life and history to try and determine anyone bearing a grudge against her as a possible suspect, though what kind of grudge does a devout Muslim woman raise unless she is the innocent target of a hate crime, I ask you? Officers were only later that afternoon to effect an arrest. By late that Sunday afternoon, residents of Fair Isle Close, evacuated for their own safety, had been allowed to return, the scene being declared as safe, and at about 5:25 p.m, two officers carrying out said routine inquiries, Detective Constables Lambert and Hickling, had knocked on the door of number 19, a flat on the first floor next to number 23, laid out the same and also having a front door accessed by the alleyway running down the back of the flat, and which had been occupied since 2015 by unemployed 31-year-old Jamie Edwin Barrow, who answered the door wearing a t-shirt bearing the words, "That's enough" on, and who invited them in. DC Hickling was to later recount in a statement that Barrow seemed quite concerned and on edge at the officer's routine inquiries, and appeared deep in thought, sat on the edge of the sofa. within minutes of the officers arriving at his home, he told them, "I need to tell you something about the fire next door." He then bowed his head and put his hands out in front of him as though inviting the officers to handcuff him before saying, "Can you get me out of here without being killed?" Now, neither officer was in possession of handcuffs, so at that stage, DC Hickling went back outside to arrange for other officers to attend, taking a body-worn video camera from one who was maintaining the scene next door, and then returned to number 19. While she was gone, Barrow had said to DC Lambert, "I was going to hand myself in at Clifton Police Station anyway today." DC Lambert then cautioned him, but didn't ask him any questions about what he had said, and Barrow did not say anything further. Shortly afterwards, other officers arrived, and it was then, at 5:33 p.m., that DC Lambert arrested Barrow on suspicion of murder times two, before he was then conveyed to Radford Road Police Station for questioning. Now, over the course of 10 interviews that were to take place over the next 5 days, Barrow had turned reluctant to discuss his remark of needing to tell them something about the fire next door to officers any further, and maintained a no-comment stance to everything that was put to him, also declining to give the PIN number to his mobile phone to police officers. Not even the news of Fatoumata's death 2 days later, making it a triple homicide he was being questioned about, could sway him from this. Now, unhelpful, but ultimately unnecessary, this stance was, for a search of Barrow's flat after his arrest was to reveal, however, in his kitchen bin, an empty clean and fresh spray bottle that, when analysed, was found to still contain traces of petrol. On Friday, November the 25th, Jamie Edwin Barrow appeared before Nottingham Magistrates Court in a 2-minute hearing, charged with the murders of Fatoumata Haidara, Fatima and Naima Drama, during which Barrow clasped his hands behind his back as he was led into the courtroom by a custody officer. He spoke clearly as he gave his details, confirming his name, his date of birth as September the 14th, 1991, and his address as also being in Fair Isle Close, and said nothing further before he was remanded in custody. At the subsequent initial hearing at Nottingham Crown Court the following Monday, November the 28th, he was remanded further and committed for trial. While Barrow was on remand awaiting trial, detectives painstakingly pieced together the evidence that hopefully a jury would convict him based upon. But over the following few months, what they struggled with was a motive. I mean, who torches a neighbouring property with three people inside, two of them very young children, knowing they have no chance of escape and risking the lives of others also, as well as the potential loss of your own property? Who does that? Though a specific motive was never established, several were suggested, including a desire for Barrow to be rehoused by Nottingham City Council so he could be closer to his son, anger over noise, or even a grievance over rubbish being left, though this would be extreme actions over such things, to say the least. By the time Barrow's trial began at Nottingham Crown Court on Monday, June the 26th, 2023, he denied the charges he faced, 3 counts of murder and a count of arson being reckless as to whether life was endangered, on November the 20th, 2022, where, without lawful excuse, he damaged by fire an address in Fair Isle Close, Clifton, belonging to Nottingham City Homes. Though, having had several months to consider his options and the evidence against him, which I'll come on to, he admitted manslaughter, claiming he thought the flat was empty when he had started the fire. His barrister, Christopher Henley KC, told the jury of 8 men and 4 women, "He accepts he is legally responsible, obviously, for the deaths of those 3 people. He says, 'Yes, I did that,' and he will be punished appropriately and severely for what he has admitted doing. A bearded Barrow listened intently through a hearing loop to the evidence during the trial at Nottingham Crown Court, wearing a pale grey top and bottoms and a pair of designer glasses. However, as the evidence unfolded, he moved from the centre of the dock more into the corner, as if trying to shield himself from the anguished glances of the grieving family of Fatoumata and her two daughters, who were watching from the public gallery. However, the Crown was having none of a manslaughter rap. Prosecutor Simon Ash KC, opening the prosecution's case, suggested to the jury that Barrow had a grievance about rubbish building up in an alleyway behind where he and the victims lived, and had contacted Nottingham City Homes, the housing arm of the City Council, on October the 26th and November the 12th of the previous year, referring to the rubbish as a health hazard. If he may have insinuated that it was the doing of Fatoumata, and this is not reported, it was not accepted that she was responsible for leaving the rubbish, as Mr. Ash said neighbours spoken to had claimed that other residents had left the items in the alleyway. He told the court in his opening address. He poured petrol through their letterbox and set it alight. The defendant knew that the front door was the only way in and out of the flat. He knew there would be no way for them to escape. Shortly after, Miss Haidara, or one of the children, started screaming. The defendant did nothing to help them. He didn't call the fire service or alert anyone to what was happening. About 5 minutes later, he walked casually away, leaving Mrs. Haidara, Fatima and Naima trapped in the burning flat. All three of them died as a result of that fire. The prosecution case was that the Saturday evening before the fire, Barrow had been at home drinking heavily. CCTV captured him at about 6:40 p.m. leaving his flat with his dog and walking to Clifton convenience store on South Church Drive, where he bought 6 cans of San Miguel Lager. Barrow was away from his flat for about 25 minutes and then remained there for about 3.5 hours, the jury heard. Before at about 10:40 p.m. that night, Barrow again left his flat with his dog, this time heading for Jay's newsagents on Rochester Walk, where he bought 4 further cans. Barrow himself was later to claim that that evening he was wallowing in self-pity, listening to what he described as depressing music, and also suffering flashbacks of physical and sexual abuse he had suffered in childhood, which led him to have suicidal thoughts and to begin self-harming. In texts to 2 friends sent around 3 hours before he lit the fire, Barrow had said, "I'm less than pond scum," and "I feel like there is no escape from the constant feeling of uselessness and inadequacy." One of these friends also, an hour later, received a picture message from Barrow showing a cut to his arm that he had made, and a registered nurse who saw Barrow at Nottingham Custody Suite on November the 20th the previous year, following his arrest, noted he had fresh, multiple linear lacerations to his left forearm and a single laceration to his right forearm, which Barrow admitted was caused by deliberate self-harm. So, with a mind filled with such sounding darkness, fueled by alcohol, in the early hours of the 20th of November the previous year, Barrow took a clean and fresh spray bottle and removed the spray nozzle, which he put in the kitchen bin, and poured away the contents, or whatever remained of them. He had then gone down to the motorcycle in the yard outside his flat, using plastic tubing to siphon petrol from the fuel tank into the plastic bottle, and had then poured this petrol through the letterbox of the family's flat, and set it alight using tissue paper. Once he had started the fire, he remained in the area of Miss Haidara's flat for 5.5 minutes, watching it burn. He was there when the fire alarm went off, and when Miss Haidara or one of the children was screaming, as the location data for Barrow's phone showed it had remained in the area of 19 and 23 Fair Isle Close from 3:07 a.m. and 29 seconds before the start of the fire until 3:15 a.m. and 21 seconds. About a minute before the caller who had first contacted emergency services arrived outside number 23, CCTV captured Barrow coming out of the alley next to the flat with his dog and walking away towards Ormiston Close, smoking a cigarette with his hood up. He was captured on several home CCTV systems over the next few minutes, identifiable by the distinct square patches on his coat, and his route also supported by his mobile phone location data over this time, walking along Ormiston Close towards Glenlivet Gardens, before returning to Fair Isle Close via Sunberg Road, and arriving back at 3:33 a.m, shown walking along the alleyway at the back of the flats there. By now, the scene crawling with emergency services. Over the next 45 minutes, Barrow remained on the edges of the police cordon, pretending he had nothing to do with the tragedy which had unfolded. Neighbours later recalled smelling alcohol on his breath, with one describing him as looking really smashed. Though he spoke to several police officers over this time, interactions which were recorded by police body-worn video cameras for all manner of things, saying, "Looks like I'm next to the fire," as he lived in flat 19, more than once that flat 17, the flat underneath his, was occupied, asking police officers how bad it was, and asking if he could go into his home to get a waterproof coat and food for his dog. Each time he spoke to a police officer, he appeared nothing but calm and composed. He was even captured smiling at one point as he gave his details nonplussed as the emergency operation got underway around him to try and save the family who he had left to die. Throughout the time he was stood there, he knew Miss Sidara and the children had been brought out of their flat by firefighters, but did never once ask the police anything about them. Residents were then evacuated to Clifton Campus at Nottingham Trent University, which Barrow went to in a police van and arrived there at 4:45 a.m. One resident the jury later heard from said Barrow would not be quiet when they got there, and that though they were in a massive area of the university, Barrow was still the lead person who was there. The jury heard the resident recall, "To be honest, I thought he was a bit of a wally," referring to Barrow, and it seemed to him that he was trying to impress and thank people. Around the time when a Dr. Ashmore at the QMC was certifying the deaths of Fatima and Naima, a housing officer from Nottingham City Homes visited the group who'd been evacuated from the Fair Isle Close flats, and Barrow piped up that he was the occupant of 19, directly next door to number 23, and wanted to know what would happen if he couldn't return to his flat as the result of smoke damage. The officer recalled later that Barrow had asked him that if there was any significant smoke damage to his personal property, would he then be able to claim compensation from the local council? Oh yes. Another resident heard Barrow asking questions about the insurance and wanting to know whether he could be rehoused somewhere else, and he was quite aggressive in his demeanour, swearing quite a lot, which he thought was because the housing officer couldn't tell Barrow exactly what would happen. Now later that morning, at 5:58, Barrow phoned police to say he'd lost his keys and to ask whether someone could check to see if they were in the police van, again seeming calm and composed, and again asking nothing about the condition of Miss Hydara and her daughters. He subsequently found the keys in his jacket pocket. He then left the campus at 9:30 a.m. and went to his aunt's home in Clifton, where he told her that there'd been a fire, the emergency services had dealt with it, and he'd been evacuated to the university campus. Barrow went upstairs and slept in the spare room for about an hour and a half, and when he came back downstairs, he and his aunt talked about reports that two children had died in the fire he'd mentioned, and that their mother was in a critical condition in hospital. Barrow's aunt later claimed he didn't seem unduly upset about what had happened and didn't say anything about Fatoumata or her daughters. Later that afternoon, Barrow phoned the police once again, this time at 15:42, and again, calm and composed, asked whether he could return to his flat, where he was told he now could. Less than 2 hours later, he had been arrested on suspicion of then double murder. The court then heard accounts of Barrow's disturbed childhood. He had lived with his mother up to the age of about 8, then with his grandmother between the ages of 8 and 14. From the ages of 14 to 18, he was living in care. Barrow told Dr. Vivek Furtado, a forensic psychiatrist who had examined him on May the 11th, ahead of his trial, that he was disruptive, angry and violent during his time in care, and would go from 0 to 100 very quickly. He told Dr. Furtado that whilst at school he was irrationally angry, that he would smash stuff up to relieve stress, and this turned to him getting into fights with other youths so he could get beaten up and feel something. He would kick off, which was the way he expressed it, and at one stage even got into a physical fight with a teacher, behaviour which led to lots of suspensions, exclusions, and time isolated at behavioural units. A second psychiatrist, Dr. Kennedy, recorded in his interview notes with Barrow that he talked about a number of occasions during his life where he had used violence against others, and his criminal record reflected this, as he had 3 convictions for 4 offences: battery and a public order offence in 2011, and more recently, possession of a knife in 2018, for which he was sentenced to 6 months imprisonment, suspended for 12 months. And chillingly, which he told both psychiatrists, that he had always fantasised about torturing people who had done wrong and held an express interest in fires, which he liked sitting and watching burn. From the age of about 11, he discovered fire had this effect on him, and started his first one when he was just 14 years old, then going on to set bonfires regularly, which Barrow said soothed him. He'd always found them cathartic. He had the same year threatened to set a person on fire using a can of deodorant, telling Dr. Kennedy, "Then I set a fire at the back of the children's home and just sat watching it for hours." Now, called as a prosecution witness, Dr. Furtado told the court that Barrow had emotionally unstable personality disorder, which could cause him to self-harm and suffer low mood. He had been diagnosed with this, an antisocial personality disorder, back in 2013, for which he'd been prescribed a number of medications, the latest being both an antidepressant medication, citalopram, and an antipsychotic, quetiapine, which helped to reduce negative thoughts and self-harm urges he was having, though Barrow admitted that he had stopped taking the latter the previous year, 6 to 8 months before the fire. Barrow had talked about his mood switching at the drop of a hat, as was recorded in his medical notes, and had described fantasising about torturing people who had done wrong. Mr. Ash asked Dr. Furtado if Barrow had said, reference fire, "Fire has always helped with stress. It's always been cathartic. When it goes up, it is always a sense of release, like the stress is going." Dr. Furtado replied, "Yes, that's correct." Mr. Ash then asked, "Did he say, the more it goes, the more mesmerised I get?" Dr. Furtado replied, "Yes, that's also correct." But Dr. Furtado disagreed with the suggestion that setting fires was Barrow's best relief of coping with stress, instead believing Barrow had an interest in them, he said. He is described having an interest in fires, not necessarily using them as a coping mechanism, and they are 2 different things. He has an interest in fire, and not necessarily starting fires to relieve stress, because it is not something he has done at every point to relieve stress. Mr. Henley, defending, asked him, "It does also perform that function on occasion." Dr. Furtado replied, "I would disagree with that. What he does mention is having a fantasy of setting fire to others in the context of violence." Barrow himself gave evidence at his trial, telling the court that he'd been suffering from a very, very low mood in the days and hours before his actions, that he had turned reclusive and had, for all intents and purposes, given up. Earlier, the court had heard that Barrow's stress had increased in the days leading up to the fire, due to him having to care for his 7-year-old son for a fortnight after he had had a fall and had ended up in hospital. By the second week, Barrow was struggling to look after the boy and had returned him to his mother on about November the 14th. In the days after this, Barrow had tried once again to pursue a relationship with a woman named Jessica Yates, who was uninterested in this and had clearly friend-zoned him, and who he had drunkenly called only mere hours before setting the fire. He himself admitted to the court that he was regularly drinking heavily, and, taking each of these factors into account, plus his lack of taking his prescribed antipsychotic medication for months, which he admitted was a mistake, Barrow had decided to light the fire after, I quote, "an elastic band snapped in his head," he said. "I got a bottle, took the lid off it, put some gloves on, went downstairs, filled the bottle with petrol, and then went round to the address and started the fire. It wasn't until I started filling it that I realised what I was going to set fire to. I knew I was going to set fire to something, I just didn't know what. I can't explain why I picked the victim's flat. I've got no explanation for that. It wasn't a thought as much as it was an impulse." He had earlier told the court, as I said, that he'd started fires from the age of 14, including setting a fire in a commercial bin whilst drunk on his 18th birthday, because it relaxed him and relieved his stress. Something he first discovered at around the age of 11, saying, "It chills me out and takes me, to a certain extent, out of the headspace that I'm in at the current time by calming it." Mr. Henley asked him, "How much thought do you give to the consequences of starting a fire?" Barrow replied, "Zero, as part of my personality is disordered and I have impulse management issues. I struggle to manage my impulses and I don't always think about the consequences of my actions." Barrow said he believed the flat to be empty and had no intention of harming anyone, adding that while he couldn't explain why he had targeted Mrs. Hydara's flat, he didn't think it would cause any harm. Yeah, straight up. He said he had not seen or heard from any of the flat's occupants for 3 or 4 days, and so targeted it as he had formed the opinion that they were not in. Now, the prosecution put to him that it would have been clear that the family were home and inside, because a silver and black pram, too heavy for Fatimata to lift up the stairs, was left outside the front door, and there was light coming from the hallway of the flat, which Barrow would have been able to see. Plus, as they'd been neighbours for years, and the bedroom wall of Fatimata's flat adjoined his living room wall, Barrow could always hear her and her children if they were at home, and would have heard two lively young children, as the two girls were that evening, when it was proven he was home, no problem. As well as hearing terrified screams, which Barrow denied. He added that after lighting the fire, he had panicked as he was not expecting it to go up like that, but he denied hearing any noises or screams, saying he would have raised the alarm if he had heard anything, and would not have done it if he'd known someone was inside the property. Upon being told by a neighbour that 3 people had been brought out of the flat, Barrow claimed to the court, "My heart sank. I realised I had done something terrible. I realised the enormity of what I had done, and I felt an immense amount of guilt for obviously causing the deaths of those 3 people." concerning Barrow's arrest after telling an officer, "I need to tell you something about the fire next door," Mr. Henley asked him, "You later bowed your head and then held your hands out in front of you. Why did you do that?" "I was handing myself in, essentially," Barrow replied. Mr. Henley asked, "Why did you want to admit starting the fire?" Barrow responded, "Because I realised the enormity of what I had done and I just wanted to be in custody because I knew what I had done was wrong." Mr. Henley asked him, "When you started the fire, was it your intention to cause serious harm or the deaths of anybody?" Barrow replied, "No, it was not. I understand that I'm responsible for the deaths of 3 individuals who sadly died, but I had no intent to actually kill them. Every day since I've done it, I have regretted the loss of life and the fact that ultimately, I caused it. I would like to apologise to the family and say I am sorry from the bottom of my heart. There is nothing that I can say or do that will ever come close to saying how sorry I am." The victim's relatives, who had packed the public gallery since the trial started, remained in a dignified silence as Barrow apologised. Ahead of closing speeches from both counsels, victim impact statements were both read and delivered to Barrow on the court, firstly being read from Fatoumata's mother, who had said, "The day I found out my granddaughter's lives had been taken by this monster, it felt like at that moment I would do anything to swap my life for theirs. I went to Sunday market in the early morning of November the 20th with the intention of buying toys for my granddaughters. Fatima wanted building blocks. I got the building blocks. Unfortunately, they'll never get to see those toys. The crime you committed against my daughter and granddaughters has caused me great emotional, psychological and financial pain, the impact of which we as a family have yet to fully understand. The way I felt over the past few months after the death of my daughter and granddaughters has been like watching a tragedy and not being able to do anything about it. I wake up every day thinking of how I'm going to adapt to the new world I've been forced into by the actions of such a heartless human being." Abubakar Drama himself took the stand to deliver his own heartfelt impact statement, addressing it directly to Barrow in the dock, and taking almost an hour to do so. Some of this statement I've already brought earlier in the episode when describing Fatoumata, Fatima and Naima, but I bring you the rest, all that's been released anyway, here, because it truly is something to hear. Abubakar told the court, specifically Barrow, "Thank you for the time. First, I want to start by giving you a brief timeline of my last moment with Fatoumata and the girls. We last saw each other in September when we went bowling. It was her first time bowling, and we went to the cinema in Beeston. When I left at the end of my trip in the early morning of September the 7th, 2022, it did not occur to me I would not see them alive again. The kids were asleep. I leaned over the baby crib that was right next to the wall and I kissed Naima on the forehead. I crawled on the bed and kissed Fatima on the forehead. Fatoumata was standing at the door and in a very emotional voice said, 'A taxi is waiting.' We hugged and kissed and exchanged, 'I love you.' I walked down the stairs and closed that door. Everything was normal, just as we'd done countless times before." Choking back tears, Abubakar then reflected on their lives, how he was there for the first scan of his firstborn, excited as a first-time parent, and how they gave him the scissors when Fatima was born and he was shaking. Telling Barrow about Fatima, he revealed the 3-year-old enjoyed watching Teletubbies, pushing a little shopping cart around Lidl, and riding the tram in Nottingham, explaining, "Fatima loved waving at the tram driver. She also imitated the announcement, 'This tram is for Clifton South. The next stop is...'" I can never get those words out of my mind. "Because of your actions, I now find it difficult to ride the tram. Like her elder sister, Aboubakar said 1-year-old Naima also lived a short but meaningful life that had been filled with joy and happiness, and recalled a trip to Gambia with Fatimata and the girls, where the family originates from, continuing. Fatimata and Fatima had a good time watering my mum's garden. Little Fatima enjoyed feeding the goats and sheep with my dad. Naima was so little, she was not even walking. Fatimata and I were grateful and happy to be parents. Our goal was to do our best and raise them to become good citizens. We did our best to teach them about our religion, as well as cultural and secular matters. Fatimata did most of this. She had clear visions and goals for them. She would do anything for them and wanted them to be good citizens. Because of you, I'm left with just pictures and videos. Because of you, we can't repeat those moments. Aboubakar then spoke of the 3 years of trying to sort the family's move to America, how their final visa interview was booked in London on November the 29th of the previous year, how he bought his ticket excitedly so he could be with them. He even described how he had walked around a shopping centre and bought gifts for his family ahead of him returning to Nottingham. Things they never saw. Mr. Drammer, who had continued to live in Minnesota following the deaths of his family, spoke of his hair turning grey every single day as he referred to the impact of their deaths and how he now feared going into hospitals after building a career to go into healthcare. He told Barrow, "I still don't know why. This is what I want to know. I don't know why. The impact of your actions span across 3 continents, Africa, America, and Europe. As a husband and a father, you have ruined me. I am irreparable. Your actions are slowly eating me up, and that will continue, perhaps until I die. Slowly, I am decaying. That is how I feel. I am angry, I am sad, I am hurt, I am heartbroken. At the same time, I am grateful for them being a part of me. I am grateful for Fatimata and the kids, as they made me a better person. I have no hatred to anybody in the world, including you. I don't know what will happen to you. What I do know is that most days, it feels like I am serving a life sentence. Whatever my life will become, I don't know. My life will never be the same. I am not even going to try. I have cried more often than I can admit to my family and friends. You had choices, but you chose otherwise. Hate, anger, destruction, I don't know. But of all the choices you had, you chose the most damaging of all. You, Jamie Edwin Barrow, acted like the judge and jury on that night and sentenced me to this. Every single day is different. Your impact is infinite, it is immeasurable, it is innumerable. I cannot quantify the impact of your actions. The only comfort I have is that you, as a person, cannot do this to anyone else in this world. I am afraid to start this all over again. I was quite taken aback putting this segment of the tale together, for unbelievably powerful words, those, eh? Several of the victims' family members wept as Aboubakar delivered this statement, as I said, over the course of almost an hour. And I can completely see why. For researching and writing this, I've welled up myself more than once digesting his words. I really have. What an incredibly moving description of loss. Heartbreaking. In his closing remarks, Mr. Ash said that the prosecution did not dispute Barrow's diagnosis of emotionally unstable personality disorder and accepted that the defendant took a decision and acted on it almost straight away. But he added that Barrow had taken a series of preparatory steps beforehand, such as siphoning petrol from his motorbike into a specific bottle, and was acting thoughtfully and deliberately in a calculated way. He continued, "He started the fire inside the front door knowing that it was a first floor flat and the front door was the only way out. At about 5 in the morning on the 20th of November, when speaking to the housing officer, Barrow asked whether he could claim compensation from Nottingham City Homes if any of his belongings were damaged by smoke. That conversation happened at a time when Mrs. Haidara and the children had been brought out of the flat and were at the Queen's Medical Centre and were either dead or in a very serious condition due to his actions. Meanwhile, Mr. Henley, mitigating on Barrow's behalf, acknowledged Barrow's behaviour during and after the fire was by any normal standards appalling, and also told the jury that Barrow had two options. He walked off, as he did, or tried to do something and raise the alarm, which he did not, he told the jury. This place isn't about judging the morality of that choice. It is about judging what his intention was when he started that fire. Jamie Barrow is realistic that anything I say on his behalf about his remorse and his regret will sound pretty hollow, and will provide precious little, if any, comfort to anyone who loved Fatoumata Haidara, Fatima Drama, and Naima Drama. Jamie Barrow's focus was principally on himself, his own struggles. His mental health was in crisis. It had been in the days following the time he spent with his son. He was going through a particularly bleak period. In essence, what you are being asked for is a dispassionate, honest answer to the question. What was the reason why Jamie Barrow set that fire? Was he doing everything at that moment, everything he could, to kill the occupants of that flat? That is effectively the prosecution's case. Or was this horribly damaged, selfish, internally driven action to satisfy something dark, broken, within Jamie Barrow? On Tuesday the 4th of July 2023, the jury took less than 7 hours to dismiss Barrow's assertions, unanimously convicting him of 3 counts of murder and a count of arson, being reckless as to whether life was endangered, after there was a clear threat the fire he started with petrol almost spread to neighbouring homes. Some members of the victim's family wept after the verdicts were delivered, whilst Barrow said nothing and showed no emotion. Now, incidentally, concerning the victim's family members, as I said, they had attended each day of the trial and throughout had showed remarkable dignity in the face of such distressing evidence. The one point where any kind of emotion was too much for family members to control was following the jury being shown a selection of CCTV and mobile phone footage that you've heard described here, showing the fire, showing the arrival of emergency services, as well as a series of some 144 digital images that had been taken by a crime scene investigator, showing the damage inside the flat and to the windows, with some pictures focusing on individual items. For example, a burned smoke detector that was still attached to the ceiling, part of the remains of the letterbox, the remains of a coat hanger opposite the front door, or burnt shoes and clothing at the bottom of the stairs. When the latter example was shown, one family member rushed towards Barrow in the dock, shouting, "Fucking bastard!" As we've said before, a sentiment you can completely understand. You are a machine if you can't. Sentencing was deferred until Friday the 7th of July, and having returned to the courtroom that day to pass sentence, watched by 4 jury members who had opted to return to witness sentencing, presiding Mrs. Justice Tipples told Barrow that the impact on Mr. Drama and his relatives had been devastating, adding, "His loss has been immeasurable, yet his dignity throughout this trial and in this court has been truly remarkable." Likewise, Fatoumata's mother, Aminata Dibba, has said that Fatoumata was a light for her, and now that she is gone, her world is dark and empty. The lives of all those who knew and loved Fatoumata, Fatima and Naima will never be the same again. The judge then ran through the facts of the case in her sentencing remarks. Now, they are somewhat lengthy and it would be nothing but repetition of what I've already brought here, so I will very largely skip these, though they do make for illuminating reading, and as always when they're available, a link for you to read them for yourselves can be found in the references in the episode show notes. As always, I do recommend that you read them as well. Concluding her remarks following listing the aggravating factors in the case, Mrs. Justice Tipples said, "I do not accept that you have shown any genuine remorse for what you have done. You have sought to minimise responsibility. You were well aware of what you were doing, and I am quite sure from what you did that you wanted to kill Mrs. Hydara and her children. You were very angry, but it is only you who knows why you did this. The reasons are impossible to understand from your evidence." On Friday the 7th of July 2023, Barrow was given one of the longest minimum terms of life imprisonment certainly that we've heard here on the show, when he was ordered to serve at least 44 years for each charge of murder. He was also given 10 years having been convicted of arson that recklessly endangered the lives of other residents, and was also made to pay a victim surcharge of £228. All the terms will be served concurrently, though 224 days will be deducted from his time spent on remand. Barrow showed no emotion and said nothing, and as he was taken down, members of the packed public gallery shouted, "Good," and "They should hang you." He will be 76 years of age, should he live that long, before ever being considered for release. Following Barrow's conviction, relatives of Fatoumata and her children released a statement describing their pain and grief, saying, "Words cannot quantify how much our family have suffered because of the horrific actions of one man. Neither can we quantify the emotional, psychological, physiological and financial impact of the crime Jamie Barrow committed against Fatoumata, Fatima and Naima. His actions were utterly heartless and cruel, and have caused a multi-generational trauma that we will never understand. Nottingham and the rest of the world have been denied potential future teachers, civil servants, doctors, who knows what they could have been. They lived a short but meaningful life. Such was the joy and happiness they brought to us all. We are extremely grateful and thankful to our family and friends, as well as the different communities within Nottingham that came together to give us support. This includes multiple communities, all from different ethnicities and backgrounds. We also wish to thank the police investigation team, the Crown Prosecution Service, Prosecution Council and members of the jury for delivering the justice today's verdicts provide. People repeatedly ask us how we as a family managed to stay calm and composed in the courtroom. The only true answer to this is the strength and patience given to us by Allah and our Khalifa, as he always advises us to follow the law of the country and to stay steadfast. The overwhelming support given to us by our Gambian community here in the UK and around the world has encouraged us to keep calm and patient. Final words of the account have to come from Aboubakar Drama, though, who, following Barrow's conviction, hugged three jurors who had returned to court for the sentencing hearing. Speaking quietly and calmly, he said the jury did the right thing, and the most important thing is for people to be protected from Barrow in the future. Asked about the length of Barrow's sentence, Aboubakar said, "In reality, nothing will be enough, even if it was life in prison without parole. But 44 years, by all standards, is pretty decent. I'm content with that, and I can sleep that no other family will have to go through this incident from him at all. Fatoumata and I lived our lives by the motto of love for all and hatred for none, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I have no hatred against him. His actions, though, I hate, but not him himself as a human being. I wish this not on anyone else. If his 7-year-old son was here, we would all hug him. We would all want him to stay safe and to be protected from anything as remotely close to this as possible." What a dignified, remarkable man. I'm sure you'll agree. The crimes of Jamie Barrow, I mean, hearing of his history and his behavioural traits, you get the feeling that this is always someone with the potential to do something. But the something he did is such a massive escalation, isn't it? I'm not quite sure how to get my head around any possible reasons for his crime. You have alcohol as a factor in the equation, you have his feelings of low mood, turmoil, whatever. And from what we've heard about his love of fires, his impulsive personality and previous use of violence, and had he, say, kicked the door in or trashed his kitchen or something, then you can understand that. I know that nowhere near equates as an example, of course, and that's maybe reactionary. But putting on disposable gloves, selecting a vessel best suited to fit through a letterbox, getting plastic tubing and siphoning petrol out, and ensuring it's the most combustible thing you can imagine, petrol, when there must have been other flammable materials more readily to hand, to set a fatal fire, well, it's a bit more thought out that, isn't it? These are actions always designed to cause, at very minimum, severe loss for someone, and Barrow now has 43 more remaining years minimum locked away to think about the horror of his actions. I am at an absolute loss to even begin to try and fathom them. What a senseless crime indeed, such a tragic waste of 3 lives, 4 if you count his own, and the lives of several others that have been changed beyond imagination. I'm more sure, as I always am with accounts such as these, how particularly struck I was with the words of Aboubakar that we've heard. His impact statement, delivered over the course of nearly an hour, must have been something to hear in full. How powerful, can you even imagine how powerful it would have been to hear? Equally, how incredible were his dignified responses following Barrow's conviction and sentencing? This is a man who's had everything dear to him taken away from him instantly, as the result of an unimaginable action, a fatal decision. And because of the character that he is, he can't be consumed with hatred for the person responsible, the act, yes, but not the actor, and instead, he expresses concern and compassion for Barrow's son, who has effectively lost his own father. I found that quite remarkable and a testament to the character of Aboubakar. I cannot begin to imagine how you would even begin to try and move on with your life following such tragedy, or how long it would take to even begin. But I truly hope that Aboubakar and the family of Fatima and Naima, do manage to one day. This episode is dedicated to them all. I would love, as always, hearing any thoughts and feedback that you may have on the tale I've brought you here in Neighbour from Hell, which you can do so in the episode thread that's now up in the show's Facebook discussion group, or if you wish to, through using any of the show's social media links. I don't mind wherever you get in touch, should you want to. With that, it's time for me to wrap up and shut up, and it's on to the next tale from the archives. Now, it's Patreon episode week upcoming here on the show, so I shall be back here on the regular Enthusiast at the beginning of next month, and I look forward to you joining me for it. All that remains for me to say is that I've been, I still am, and hopefully still will be Paul, the true crime enthusiast, wishing you all good and safe times, and I shall speak to you very soon. Take care all, stay safe, thanks very much for joining me, and goodbye for now.